Hello and welcome to the second episode of Rights and Wrongs, a podcast about rights, privileges, and misconceptions. Today's episode is on environmental and resource rights. Today I'm joined by Abe Drayton and Scott Twigg. I'll let them introduce themselves. Would you like to begin with that, Abe?
Hi, my name's Abe Drayton. I'm a writer and science educator. I've got a bachelor's degree in biology from Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana, with a focus on ecology. And I've been focusing on climate change in particular for about a decade now. I've done some curriculum writing, lesson plans and the like for science teachers. And these days I'm working on my own, studying climate change and politics and writing about it and how to make a better world.
All right. And Scott.
Yep, I'm Scott Twigg. I am a postgraduate student at the University of Glasgow. This is how I met George. I'm currently studying a master's in international politics and human rights, similar to George. I have an undergraduate degree in philosophy. I have a strong research background in climate change. My undergraduate, I looked at climate change through the perspective of distributive justice, and specifically how we share the burdens associated with mitigating and adapting to climate change between states. And this year, I've kind of refocused my research into a human rights perspective, specifically looking at how the human rights framework is, how well it's placed to tackle climate displacement, specifically in Haiti, but also kind of with a global perspective to it. I've got a passion for climate change and environmental rights, and I'd like to thank George for having me here today, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Thanks for both of you coming. So today we're going to be doing a dual interview where both of these guests are going to provide unique views into this issue. We're going to start with Scott, who's going to give us about a 10-minute introduction into what was the original view?
I'm looking at kind of the debate of climate change being a human problem compared with a political phenomenon as well. So I've got a bit of an introduction for this topic. If you want me to just go ahead, George.
Go right into it.
And kind of enlighten your listeners to how climate change has been influenced by the political world and how that's affecting the current debate around climate change and policy and litigation and principles. Climate change, I think, as we know and acknowledge, is innately a human problem by its nature. It has human effects and arguably human causes, anthropogenic climate change. Yet, for the last maybe 40 to 50 years, has really been subject to political dilemmas and political difficulties. And this is because the problem of climate change has become politicized. And in my opinion, and in many other human rights scholars' opinions, such as John Knox or David Boyd, believe that human rights has a place within this debate, and that the fact that the climate change debate has become such a political phenomenon has, in some respects, hampered the work that has happened in the last 40 years. But I think maybe to properly grasp how the climate change debate has evolved in the last 40 years, it's probably best to have a little bit of a history on how the nexus of climate change and human rights, or climate change as a human problem, has kind of come about and where it is today. The problem of climate change and the political problem of climate change largely came about to the kind of the forefront of the debate in the 1960s through grassroots movements, such as Greenpeace and obviously science, and was somewhat involved in politics, but mainly on the peripheral of politics at the time. In the 1960s, and especially in the States, it was mainly around disarmament, nuclear disarmament, but the climate change debate really interjected into politics in the 1960s. Human rights at that point was just not involved in the debate really at all. Then in 1972, there was a UN conference in Stockholm where there was a declaration on the human environment, it was called. And this declaration largely cemented climate change as a kind of human problem. This declaration wasn't world changing, should I say, but it created the nexus between the two. And from there, we've seen human rights and the climate change debate kind of grappling with one another, but never really definitively taking hold of each other. But the nexus continued to develop. In 2006, I think the state is right, there was a declaration by the Maldives called the Mail Declaration. I'm probably horrendously mispronouncing that, but it's the capital city of Maldives, which categorically linked climate change with human rights. And for some context, the Maldives is a series of low-lying islands. And I think this is correct. And by 2050, 30% of the Maldives is uninhabitable. This is by rising sea levels and saltification of land. And the Mail Declaration was basically a group of similar small island states who suffer the same kind of threats, climate change threats, banding together and basically saying that this isn't bad, this isn't good, and climate change threatens human well-being in these states and the human rights of people in these states, in these small lying island states. And that declaration was kind of landmark in this nexus between human rights and climate change. However, it was, of course, a declaration by small island states, so it doesn't have a huge impact on international systems and relations. Even in light of these declarations, and there's many more, the debate around climate change has still been largely shadowed by economic discourses of cost-benefit discourses. The Kyoto Protocol in the 1990s, is largely focused around an economic discourse. And of course, there's complex scientific and philosophical debates around the climate change debate. So, even today, the Paris Agreement in 2016, which is by no stretch of the imagination a failure, it is the most successful climate agreement in history. And I don't really contest that. However, the agreement made scant reference to human rights. In my opinion, that is a failure. As I stated at the start, climate change is, by its very virtue, a human problem. It has extreme human consequences for hundreds, if not millions, of people. And if we continue to buy in to the idea that climate change is a political problem, purely a political problem, that has economic and scientific faction, which it does, but if we continue to buy into that and ignore the human rights and human dimension of climate change, I believe, and I think other writers and scholars also believe, that legislation, policy, and principles will fail to seriously tackle the problem of climate change, the human problem, displacement, poverty, saltification, desertification. And that's basically where I think the debate is today. It's where, well, personally, where I stand is that I think human rights should transcend this whole debate and should anchor policy. The Paris Agreement should have been anchored in human experience and human problems. And I think when we start recognizing that, we can come together as a race of people and have some tangible solutions to this really awful problem. So thank you. That's kind of for my part. So I'm here if you guys have any questions or anything to say, how you think this debate should work.
Did you have any questions for me?
No, not really. My perspective on it is much the same, honestly. I've been somewhat active in sort of communicating about climate change, mostly from a scientific perspective, for about a decade. And in the sort of the activist circles that I follow, the overwhelming feeling has been one generally of there's a lot. There are many feelings, so many feelings. But there's been a lot of frustration with, as was mentioned, the sort of the cost-benefit economic analysis of this as though it's somehow separate from issues of well-being. I think it comes from sort of buying into the sort of the modern capitalist framework of, you know, if we attend to the economy, all the other good in the world will follow. And so all of the arguments were always made in an economic lens, and I agree, that's been an utter failure, because at the end of the day, it wasn't about the actual numbers so much as getting the results that a certain number of people wanted.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, I mean, I fear that I maybe came across then as someone who's anti kind of scientific knowledge and wants to expel that from the debate. And that isn't, you know, it's not the case entirely. I'm sure that some people within the movement, within grassroots movements, feel that way. But I think it's a balancing game. And you know, one of the discussion prompts today was, you know, how do we circumvent climate change deniers? And I think if we refocus the debate and principle and policy on this real understandable human experience, people losing land, not just losing sovereignty, but, you know, losing the land where they live, we can circumvent these climate change deniers and this kind of distrust in climate change debates from people by really using the human rights framework and language to overcome that. But in saying that, as you said, the cost-benefit analysis of the conversation, of the debate and solutions, the cost-benefit solutions, play into the kind of capitalist globalization that exists today. But that is somehow unfortunately useful in the debate. I mean, a lot of the green technology and green innovation is going to massively succeed and improve because of that economic dimension to the debate. But I think it all needs to be agendered properly, and human rights can do that. We shouldn't forget that it's a human problem, you know, and those other things can feed in beneath it, if that makes sense.
That actually gets really interesting when, like, what you're going to talk about, Abe, too, is how we do politicize environmental rights. You're going to be going a lot into, like, water rights and, like, privatization of that, which but the one thing I've always found it fascinating about is, like, when it comes to the idea of environmental rights, it seems, especially in the United States, it's a little bit different here in the UK and Europe, which is nice to see. But in the US, it seems to be environmental rights are either you're for the environment and putting these restrictions, or you're pro-capitals. Like, it's a very drawn line, where in a lot of issues, I've always, like, the more I've been looking into, like, buying land for myself and, like, building my own, like, house and cabin, there's a lot of strange things about the laws in there. Like, a lot of states in the U.S. ban people from gathering rainwater on their own property. Like, that was my first introduction to environmental rights and these politicized fighting. Was the base I was in North Carolina was in a fight with the state of North Carolina because they would collect rainwater in these pools around the brand new barracks, which were beautiful, and they would use that water for the toilets and the showers to, like, preserve water. But North Carolina was trying to go after the Marine Corps because it's, even though it's federal land, it's in state environmental restrictions, and that's against North Carolina law. Which was really strange, like, how, like, something like that could be politicized, like, that governments can now tell you what to do with your own resource on your own property. And that's where I've always found it fascinating.
It's related
to...
What
I was going to say is, in my own introduction, I'll get a little bit into some of the history of politicizing of environmental issues in general. I do want to be clear, Scott, I didn't think you were suggesting that... the scientific angle was a problem.
No.
It's been interesting because within activist circles, there has been a lot of focus on the science And initially, there have been multiple angles. There's the environmental justice angle is a long-standing issue around the world, but I've been mostly focused on the United States because just that's where I grew up. But it's wherever you find poorer communities, communities of ethnic minority, Black communities in particular, and Native American communities in particular, that's where you're also going to find a lot of some of the worst environmental problems with air pollution, proximity to industrial activity, water pollution, and all that other stuff. And I don't need to get into it right this moment. But it took a while for the kind of... The environmentalist movement had a kind of colonial flair to it during the 20th century. And it's taken a while for that to sort of coalesce with other movements that are naturally aligned, but for various reasons weren't coordinated. And so I think 21st century environmentalism is turning into something a lot more, well, coherent than 20th century environmentalism was. So it'll be interesting to see. I just, you know, wish it wasn't going to be under these circumstances.
Well, yeah, if you want to go right into your history of it, that'd be great.
Oh, sure. Well, so I was going to talk about water rights and the sort of the current push to privatize water in general, but I think it'd be good to sort of take a couple steps back and, I don't know, take a running start into it, so to speak. Since we've been talking about politicization, I definitely recommend anybody who hasn't already looked into it to look into the work of, I think it's Naomi Oreskes and her book Merchants of Doubt, which sort of goes into the history of capitalist involvement in the politics of science. And it's a fascinating story because you go back, you can find... there are a number of ways to trace it, but like one of the earlier bits was the anti-nuclear movement was met by a number of physicists and corporations, and also the U.S. government took some involvement, kind of... Some of it was legitimate in that some of the fear of things like nuclear power was and continues to be overblown. There's a great line where I forget who said it, but they said that, you know, the more somebody becomes an expert in nuclear power, not talking about weapons here, just civilian power plants, the less it frightens them. And the more somebody becomes an expert in climate change, the more it frightens them. And while I do have my own reservations on nuclear power, it's the movement against it, I think, went a little overboard at times. But at the same time, there was a corporate involvement, some really wacky people who, you know, took the stance that actually humanity would benefit from just more exposure to radiation. And, you know, maybe we should deal with radioactive waste by sprinkling it across the landscape in a very diffuse manner. Weird stuff. That led into the issue of lead in gasoline and other sources, and the effort to squish awareness of the crisis that was happening globally of lead levels increasing, mostly from leaded gasoline, and just poisoning everybody for decades with a neurotoxin. And the, I think Neil deGrasse Tyson's Nova Science thing had a really good sort of summary of that story, but basically the needs of capital and of corporate interests delayed reporting on the scale of the lead crisis for years, which, as has been pointed out, you know, it's a little weird that it got there because we've known that lead is a neurotoxin since, oh, I don't know, the Roman Empire. Like, it's been a couple thousand years since we sort of figured that out. And yet, there was money to be made because it's, if you ignore the human, if you can ignore human rights and like the whole thing where it's a poison, it's a really useful material. You can do a lot of cool stuff with lead. It's very soft. You can make pipes out of it. You can do all sorts of neat things. And so you can make a lot of money with it if you just sort of externalize the costs of, you know, people getting permanent brain damage from exposure to lead as children, for example, which the United States did, according to some theories, by increasing policing to an incredible degree and becoming the most carceral state in the world. It all gets a bit hairy. So the lead people involved in that then moved into the movement of opposing public awareness and accountability on cigarettes and the fact that cigarettes cause cancer. And again, it's some of the same people that you saw during the nuclear issue. And then those people then moved straight into climate denial. And so there was, by the time climate change really hit public awareness, there was a pre-existing infrastructure of corporate misinformation around scientific issues. There's a lot of power involved in that, and it's very difficult to fight against that, and nobody really, you know, people didn't entirely know how, and people didn't entirely understand the climate issue. Pivoting to water, I mean, it relates to the lead thing to a degree. There's many communities in the United States and other places around the world that have problems with lead in their water, among many, many other chemicals of varying degrees of ugliness. But we live in a kind of global capitalist system. There are some little pockets of arguably non-capitalist countries here and there, but basically everybody needs to participate in the capitalist system to some degree. In a big way, the Cold War was kind of the project of enforcing that regime. And that's meant a lot of things, but primarily capitalism operates by enclosing public resources, putting them into private hands, and then using those resources to make profit for the new owners of that. And so some of that was done under feudalism, where, you know, the feudal lords already owned things by virtue of being feudal lords. And a lot of it was done under colonialism and the expansion into land currently used by or owned by, depending on how you want to discuss ownership issues, people who were not able to fight back against their invader. And the amount of the world left to enclose for private profit, has kind of shrunk. There's not a whole lot left. I think it's worth avoiding the notion that, you know, there was all this land to be discovered and exploited during them old pioneering days, because the land, to be clear, had people living on it, and that exploitation and discovery meant, you know, removing them one way or another. But the amount of land that's sort of left to be exploited by an industrial capitalist society is dwindling fast. And so the process of sort of enclosure of new commons to generate new capacity for profit to fuel endless growth is moving into different areas, one of which is now fresh water. And so there are a number of corporations that are going around the world buying up access to and enclosing fresh water sources. And, you know, once they lay claim to an area, they will then defend their right to it. And sometimes the United States will come in and help them do that. And it's it's taken a very sort of predatory angle. So when colonialism kind of ended up declining, there was a process of nominal liberation during which the colonized countries, they would take back their countries, but they were also required to give corporate interests access to their natural resources, often at very, very, well, corporations got the better end of the deal. And so you'll hear sometimes people talk about how, you know, when you have a country like Venezuela, all of the invasions or the efforts at coup and all of that stuff in Venezuela were justified because the left-wing Venezuelan government seized control of the oil deposits and refineries. And that was the property of various global corporations. And therefore, it was justified to treat them as, you know, a thief state, because they stole that property, which had kind of been strong-armed away from them in the first place. But this dynamic has resulted in many formerly colonized nations being placed either in extreme debt in exchange for control over their own resources by sort of the global capitalist infrastructure, World Bank, IMF, things like that, or they just don't have control over their natural resources, and so they don't get any profit from them. And so what you end up with is a lot of areas where people don't have any money, and they need it for various resources, but all of the wealth of their nations is being extracted and sent elsewhere to make, you know, some jackass on the other side of the world rich. And so you get a company like Nestle that comes in and says, hey, we'll give you a whole bunch of money. All you need to do is let us take over your water infrastructure. And, you know, we'll still sell you the water. There'll be maybe a slight increase, but it will be more efficient. So, it ought to just be about the same. And you'll get this big influx of cash for the community. And they take over the water, and now they own it. These corporations at this point, like Nestle, are massive, and they have globally more power than most small nations. And so you end up with, anytime there's it's one of those things where, like, day to day, water prices go up a bit, but most people sort of just make do. But then you have a crisis, like a drought or a flood, and suddenly access to water is a lot harder to get. And now we've got this whole supply and demand thing going on where either the people have to pay exorbitant prices for bottled water, which may have been bottled from water sources that used to be free for them or much cheaper, or the government has to pay for access to that water. And either way, tribute must be paid to Nestle.
I don't mean to cut you off right there, but you're coming up on your 20 minutes. Hey, sure. Do you have any, like, quick finishing part on that?
Just to add that, like, this is compounded by the history of industrial pollution of water sources. So I did just quickly want to mention the Elk River chemical spill in 2011, maybe, in West Virginia, where basically a coal washing chemical was spilled out into the river upstream of the municipal water intake, and all of a sudden nobody had access to safe drinking water. It wasn't just because the river was poisoned, it was because the groundwater had already been poisoned long before, and the river was the only safe-ish drinking water left. And so it's been coming from two different angles, and now I will back off.
Oh, you're fine. Did you have any thing you wanted to ask, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, lots. I have to admit, I'm somewhat aware of the privatization of water. And it is, I have to admit, quite incredible how much power these companies such as Nestle and Dayon, who own Evian Water and various other, it's a food production company. These companies operate, you know, in 80% of the globe. It's crazy. One thing that I was going to ask, maybe, seeing as we're having a rights conversation, is that how common is it in legislation in nations and big developed nations as well, like the United States, Australia, Canada, United Kingdom, most of Europe, to have right protection of water? So is it common for it to be written into constitutions that the people of a nation have a right to their water source? Or is this something that has been completely squashed by these humongous corporations?
So I don't know the details everywhere. Honestly, I don't know the details anywhere, but I think that one of the problems is that water has been a commons for so long that there's a degree to which people never really saw a need to legislate that everybody has access to water, because of course you do. It's right there. It's flowing down the river. Just go get some. And so while there's been a lot of legislative protection of water sources through things that might affect natural water sources, that's generally been with the assumption that those water sources are a commons. There are some ostensibly reasonable thoughts behind the restrictions on rainwater collection in certain parts of the United States, for example. Misguided, I think, but a lot of it has been about preserving the commons, and now that the commons is being privatized, there isn't really an infrastructure to respond to that. And at least in the United States, there's been an ongoing rhetoric of the universal ultimate goodness of capitalism and privatization. And so the corporations are specialists in talking to legislators behind closed doors and using money to solve short-term problems for their long-term benefit. And so it is a complicated issue. But I guess the short answer is I don't know, but for the most part, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot, and that's why there's so much discourse now about the notion of water as a human right, because suddenly we're realizing that it's not treated as such in any meaningful sense, and if it's not treated as such, well, a right that is a right in name only doesn't really mean much.
You do also have some laws in the U.S. that do, unquote, protect people's access to water. But in many ways, these laws are ambiguous, and they're written in ways that are up to interpretation. A prime example is if one of the references that I added was, in some states, technically off-grid living is illegal. When off-grid living, meaning like you're producing your own water, you're collecting rainwater, producing your own power, and all the other stuff. In most states, like having solar panels aren't illegal. Having wind power is not illegal. Collecting rainwater off your own or using a well or something like that to access your own water, these aren't illegal. But a lot of state, city, and county legislation has been passed that in order to protect and make sure that you have access to water, you have to be connected to the municipal or county water supply. So the reason why sometimes people get very hesitant of these laws is because they almost force you to have these things. And like, there's been cases where people are like, oh, I don't need that. I'll take it on my own. And then these cities and counties then turn around and deem your structure unsafe or unfit for human living. And they condemn you and tell you you can't live on your own property. So that's another issue in U.S. Like, it's one of those things that's great if you do have these laws, but you have to watch out who's writing the laws. But I'm not sure if that's a European issue. You'd know better than I do, Scott, on that.
Yeah, I'm unsure. I know in England that you pay per, say, pay per liter of water that you use. And obviously that is from commons water, you know, from the water out of your tap. But I don't know what the law is on, obviously, then collecting your own water. If you have a natural well spring in your property, whether or not, I mean, I assume you wouldn't be legally required to pay for that water. But interestingly, it's devolved in Scotland. So in Scotland, nothing's free. Water isn't free because you pay for it through your tax, but you don't pay per unit of water that you use, like you do in England. And of course, Scotland is very, very rich in natural resources and obviously natural sources of safe drinking water as well. So, I mean, if I was to give my kind of guess on how it stood in Scotland, I would say that there doesn't need to be laws necessarily to protect the water because you are de facto entitled to it, if you know what I mean. Everyone's entitled to the commons. But in England, I would say because it's more capitalist driven, the water sources there, that if there are protections in place, rights for water, they would not be to protect the common person, the common citizen, but to monetize the water and actually protect it in terms of protect it for investors who, you know, use that water and ultimately charge the citizen for it. I can only think of shot in the dark, but in Scotland is definitely free in one sense, as opposed to England.
Well, like, that's also the fascinating thing about that I find, how our planet's covered by 70% of water, but this is like an issue. And, like, one thing I've always found fascinating is taking the U.S. having a water crisis issue, where even like, yeah, we have deserts and stuff like that. We have two massive coastlines on both the Pacific and Atlantic Ocean, but we only collect, I think last time I checked, it was like 3% of our water comes from the ocean. Where if you look at nations such as like Israel and other nations, that like only like 2% of their entire nation touches water, yet over 50% of their water comes from desalinization.
I mean, I'd have to guess why that is. I'm sure Abe knows why, but I'd imagine it involves cost. And why only 3% of the water, whatever statistic it was.
Well, I think one of the factors that's worth considering, at least, is there's a degree to which capitalism, at least currently, revolves around the creation of artificial scarcity. So one of the more famous examples is diamonds. The diamond industry is very small in terms of the number of people who control it, and they keep the supply to the public low to keep the price high. Similar things have been observed in housing. There are many cities that have many more empty homes than they have homeless people, and part of that is because that keeps the price high, because it keeps demand higher relative to the ostensible supply. And so there is a degree to which it is more profitable for there to be a shortage in access. The other thing I just wanted to mention was that the notion of access under at least modern capitalism is a really slippery concept. The United States healthcare system, for example, I have heard people say that everybody has access to healthcare, which means that everybody can buy it if they have the money. And so there's some danger in ensuring that people have access to something, because it's a theoretical concept that there's already infrastructure to exploit that to ensure that access remains theoretical, because, you know, I have access to a Lamborghini.
Talking about the healthcare thing, that also brings us into the last point about how COVID-19 is affecting pushes forward into environment. I know you had a lot of notes on that, Scott. Did you want to start us off?
Yeah, I mean, this is very much a kind of open conversation, but I do think, you know, especially in the time of crisis where resources, commons resources, and climate change itself really become heightened, as race of people had a chance to really sit back and reflect on the things that are important for life and important for well-being, what needs to be done to ensure that these can exist post-COVID in a sustainable manner. And I mean, recently, your listeners will be able to see in the references, there's been some really interesting plans put forward by the International Energy Agency on recovery plans. And a lot of that is based around investing in green technologies, carbon storage, you know, utilization, green transport, climate-friendly fossil biofuels, and hydrogen fuels. I'm trying to find my messy notes. And of course, water will come into this debate as well, and how we can manage resources after a kind of a change perspective on the international relations and systems after COVID. But of course, I think we're going to see big changes, and we have means to be optimistic about what's going to happen. But if I can maybe tie it into what I was talking about before, and about the issue of climate change and the issue of resources as well, because they're by the nature essential to human life. So again, a human problem, a human dilemma. I feel like if we can center these recovery plans around benefits for humans instead of benefits for capitalism, as we've already talked about a lot in this podcast, we could really make a big difference. I mean, I watched some of the IEA yesterday had a international summit on their recovery plan for post-COVID, which will be starting in, I think, at the end of summer, when there'll be cash injections to governments around the world to create green jobs and green innovation and green technology, and change transport systems and possibly water supplies. But again, I watched some of it and read through the summary. But although, of course, the IEA is an energy group, so of course they're not a human rights organization. But again, the debate was divulged from this kind of this human impact, and quite unfortunately, even though energy is essentially money, it was completely focused around this cost benefit analysis of climate change, and basically, the things that I'm interested in this recovery plan is how we balance these things against climate change, how we balance economic recovery with our net zero plans and human well-being and human welfare, and how much of a place does rights language have in the energy debate and the recovery plans that we're currently seeing that nations are putting forward. I mean, the United Kingdom put one together, I think, 4 days ago and released the Green Recovery Plan, or whatever it was called. Yeah, and I'm interested in seeing where rights language can fit into that, and again, like I said, how we balance our recovery with these other factors that I think are important in the debate.
One thing I'm going to find really interesting about it is the, like, if you watch, like, because of COVID-19, less people have been traveling through vehicles or cars or trains or however you want to see, the cost of oil has dropped dramatically. And I'm almost wondering if, like, talking about economics, because how that really pertains to an environment, I wonder if that also might put, like, a strain back and, like, a pushback. It's more looking at the U.S. just because how cheap gas and oil is by the U.S. And for any European or UK listeners, the cost of gasoline, what we pay per gallon, is very similar to what you pay per liter. That's the reason why you see a lot of Americans driving these giant, massive trucks, and like people think, like, oh, how are you paying for it? Good chance someone driving a pickup truck is paying less than you're paying to fill up your Fiat. And because of this price differential, I'm almost wondering if it's going to be a pushback away from things such as like the Tesla cars or any other like power sources, just because right now you have such a drop. Like, I remember, I think one of the Saudi companies was basically giving oil away a couple months ago because they were drilling so much and no one was buying it. So I was just curious if either you, Abe or Scott, had like any views on that and for the future of them.
Well, there was an interview and it's on the reading list in the, what month was it, in May's New Scientist advertisement, almost, with a guy called Petteri Talas, who is the CEO of the Meteorological Organization, so like the weather people, who obviously have create massive reports on climate change and climate change impacts. And in one respect, COVID hasn't been a good thing for tackling climate change. This is because innovation has slowed completely for a year, a grind to a halt. Investment now has to be redirected to other essential services, essential infrastructure, the furlough scheme in the United Kingdom, where people who aren't familiar with it, was during COVID, staff were paid 80% of their salary by the British government. And that would have, of course, increased government borrowing. But lots of the funding that would have gone into innovation and green technology has been bypassed and completely stopped. So in one respect, COVID hasn't been good. However, in coming out of it, I think we'd be hard placed to not be optimistic. We've obviously seen a sharp drop in CO2 emissions. And I think it's generally the consensus among people in this debate that that drop in CO2 emissions won't be enough. But the change in behavior necessary to achieve like-for-like drops in emissions doesn't need to be anything like the change in behavior for COVID. And the change to our lifestyle, apart from maybe not driving as many diesel cars, will not be noticeable or massively noticeable. And of course, we keep going back to these big corporations, and they're the people whose behavior needs to change and needs to be properly monitored. So I would say that I'm optimistic, and people are optimistic. I think there'll be small but noticeable changes in our behaviors. But really what it falls down to is a proper recovery plan that, if we want to talk in reference to this conversation, that monitors companies that go after water sources, monitors airline companies properly, and as an international family, I suppose, use cliches, enacts these things. I mean, as a matter of fact, COP26 will be in Glasgow. It was meant to be in Glasgow this year, but it will be next year, and it will be I'm not sure when it's in 2021, but it will now. Very, very interesting to be the UN conference on climate change.
Awesome. Coming close to time, I was just going to say, I wanted to get Abe's opinion on this, and then we might have time to answer one or two questions from the audience here at Twitch. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Abe.
No.
I just wanted to put in one thing on the idea of innovation. So on the one hand, there's a degree to which it's needed, but part of the process of innovation and sort of the development of new technologies has always been through implementation of existing technologies. And so, for example, my sort of favorite for nuclear power would be the liquid fluorine thorium reactors, which operate at a lower temperature than conventional fission plants, have much less, or I think zero meltdown ability, like it's just not a thing that can happen. And more importantly, require far, far less water or no water at all for cooling, which is going to be a big thing in sort of, you know, you don't want to be competing with the local power plant for your drinking water, if possible, if there's a shortage. But a lot of the technologies that we need exist already. They are not perfect, but through putting them into practice, you discover problems and ways to fix them. And so I think that there's been a bit of a delaying tactic in focusing on innovation a little bit too much, which keeps real action on the issue always, you know, 5 to 10 years away when we figure out something better. And also, at the same time, delays the process of figuring out better things, because we're not putting things into practical application, discovering better ways to do it, and so on. So I think we're at a point where we're starting to move away from that sort of delaying reflex around innovation, but it's still very much a thing, and it's, I think, worth paying attention to.
Yeah, so I'd like to note two of the reports that the International Energy Agency released was exactly that point, that the four main technologies that are needed with investment in are things that already exist: the electrification of transport and heating, carbon capture, bioenergy, and low carbon and hydrogen fuel. So I'd like to note as well, yeah, that I agree. I think the innovation has been somewhat of a delaying tactic. But the IEA, and hopefully therefore parts of the international community, hopefully recognize that now, and investment will be going into these four main categories that we're all aware of and the potential that they have.
All right. Are you guys ready for to answer a few questions? All right. So while we're waiting, if anyone wants to type up a last-minute question real quick, I was going to give the opportunity. Scott, you had a book you wanted to recommend to our listeners?
I'm going to have to get it covered with the authors. Sorry.
Abe, if you wanted to talk about your blog.
Okay. I guess just a quick plug vlog. I focus on loosely on climate change, but on a variety of things. Free Thought Blogs is a blogging network that sort of began largely focused on the old school concept of free thought. It's an atheist blogging network, but sort of broke off from the so-called new atheist movement over social justice issues back in the day a little bit. So it's broadly focused on issues of dogma, science. One of the more prominent bloggers has generally been focused on the issue of teaching creationism in the classroom and how that's a problem. My blog, as I said, focuses on climate change and I guess you could say human rights. And sort of my focus on it is that I would like the world to get better for everybody. And we're entering a period during which the conditions of the world are getting worse for everybody. And the way I tend to look at it is that we are, in effect, on a new planet. And it's got a climate unlike anything humanity has seen before. To be clear, the last time CO2 levels were this high in the atmosphere was about 15 million years ago, which, you know, humans were not around in our present form at that point in time. And so we're heading into times where the planet is hostile to us in a way that it hasn't been since we sort of developed technology. And so we're going to be, as our ability to cope with the troubles of the planet has gotten bigger, now we're getting bigger troubles that are outweighing our existing coping mechanisms. And so I would like to find ways to weather the storm that we can't avoid, avoid what we can, and keep making the world better all at the same time. And I sort of feel like if we don't take that aspect to it, we will not survive. And I think that, well, extinction is a real possibility with this. Events like this drive other species extinct all the time. And we rely a great deal on the rest of life on this planet. And so while things like algae farms and there are, to paraphrase the Matrix, levels of existence that we are prepared to accept, but it would be better not to go there if we can find another way forward. And so we need to sort of take responsibility for our current role as a major force acting upon the systems of nature and sort of take control of what we're doing to the planet before it kills us. And so that's largely what my blog is focused on. And if you want to support it, check out freethoughtblogs.com/oceanoxia. And you can also support my work at patreon.com/oceanoxia. And if you do that, you get a few extra benefits and the occasional science fiction story. So, yeah, that's me.
All right, and Scott, your book?
Yeah, I'm currently doing work on climate displacement. And I've recently come across an organization called Displacement Solutions. And they're basically working by looking for land solutions to people that are already climately displaced. And they work with the UN and other NGOs in creating policy to protect these people who are either threatened in the process of being displaced or are currently displaced. They pressure governments to use this policy to protect these people. And they recently released what seemed to be the only policy on explicitly protecting climatically displaced people, called the Peninsula Principles. And they have a fantastic book, which is about the formation of these principles, why they're there, what obligations they put on the states, why they're important. And I presume, George, you'll be putting a link for the book. But here it is. It's called Repairing Domestic Climate Displacement by Scott Lackey and Chris Huggins. For £30. The money that you used to buy it goes towards the organization who are doing great things to tackle climate displacement and hopefully find some sort of land solution to these people who are already feeling the very, very harsh consequences of climate change. And I suppose as a kind of closing statement that I'd like to say, I was having a conversation with my mother a few days ago about graffiti and how humankind has this innate feeling to leave a mark on the world. I mean, when you look at any civilizations that existed before, there are always cases of of people, humans leaving marks on things to be remembered and have a legacy. I mean, you can go to the Northern Territory in Australia and find handprints that are thousands and thousands of years old, or you can go to Egypt and find pyramids that are humongous and have been built to mark a moment in history. And graffiti is very much the same thing, and it's just a different form of that. And that's a way that modern people are remembered by putting their names on walls, and that's happened for years. And we study them now. There's another dimension to it. We look for these marks to find out how these people existed and how they wanted to be remembered. And all I say to people now, and it's true, the more you study climate change, the more depressing it seems, is that let's think about the mark that we leave. Let's think about our handprint on the wall or our footprint in the sand, and let's make sure that that footprint can be studied, because as Abe just said, it could very well end up in extinction, and our footprint would be the antithesis of what the other footprints have been. It will be the one that destroys them all, and that's very sad, and that is why this is very important. So yeah, I mean, apart from that, buy the book. I've really enjoyed the conversation today, and let's leave a good footprint and a good hand on the wall for other people to see.
Well, thank you. And if environmental rights and like resource rights isn't always your cup of tea, which I understand for a lot of people, there are a few other things I would suggest reading. Such, if you're looking at more about like international relations and security, I would suggest checking out the Student Strategy and Security Journal, or known as 3SJ. It's a student-led academic journal based in the University of Glasgow. There's a lot of interesting information and articles on topics ranging from foreign policy to grand strategy and IR theory. They also provide the opportunity, if you want to be published, if you go on their guidelines, you can submit your papers, usually academic articles, and you might end up in their journal. Another article I would suggest looking at is Shiro. They focus a lot on domestic and sexual violence, a lot of great information. They are a Thailand-based organization, but a lot of the information is applicable no matter where you are. They are currently help spearheading the movement that sexual and domestic-based violence should not be a private matter, and we should be speaking about it openly to help end it. If these issues or any of the stuff from 3SJ interest you, check them out. I have the links provided with the rest of the reference material. To end it off, I would like to answer a question that was asked from the chat from our Twitch audience. Individual said, I believe our form of capitalism can work for us, make as much money as possible and pay the bills, then spend the rest of it on things such as the environment or improving neighborhoods, but only after we let professionals or scientists decide where best to spend it. Not really much a question, but more of a statement. I wasn't sure if you guys have agreements with it or...
Nope, I disagree.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it sounds like kind of antagonistic. yeah, I mean, I disagree. Unfortunately.
We might go a little bit more into detail about it.
Well, I'd let Abe again first, you know, go shoot.
Well, so the first thing is just that the current sort of Gordon Gekko greed is good model that we're working under means that there's not really a limit to how much money people with a lot of money want. And there's some evidence that actually, like, extreme wealth fucks with your brain a little bit. Excuse my Anglo-Saxon. But if human well-being is not the priority, history has shown that human well-being will be neglected. That has always been the case. And every time we've had an advance in sort of the human condition, it's kind of been by fighting against capitalism. A recent example would be the American Civil Rights Movement, which affected the economy in a number of ways, but everybody involved in it was condemned by the centrists and right wing of the time, among other things, as being communists or communist sympathetic. And the FBI was involved in trying to take down Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. Because of that, the Red Scare was also used to crush the labor movement in the United States. There was a, in the beginning of the 20th century, there was a powerful labor movement and a powerful socialist movement in the United States. And that was part of how we got the New Deal. And all of the rights that Americans often have these days to things like 40-hour work week, where you get overtime, time off, weekends, safe working conditions, and all of that was over the objections of the capitalist class, who generally prophesied that every single change like that would destroy business, kill innovation, and, you know, cause mayhem and chaos and anarchy. And they have always been wrong, because they were always making it up to try to keep their own power. And so if we don't center human well-being and human needs, they will be neglected. You can see that even right now with the massive resources needed in the United States to deal with the current pandemic, and that's not being dealt with. Hundreds of thousands of people are getting sick and dying there, and the richest of the rich are adding hundreds of billions of dollars to their collective wealth at the same time. And likewise, we've known about climate change as a thing, that this particular, like the human-caused global warming, since the 1890s. We've known that it was going to be a problem in the near future since the 1950s. And we've known that it was going to be a problem in our lifetimes since at least the 1980s. And there's been a need for resources to be spent on that, and instead they have been spent on delaying action and misleading people and spreading misinformation and propaganda. And so now we're at a point where we can no longer expect the planet to stop warming in the lifetime of anybody currently on the planet or any of their grandkids, barring some kind of carbon capture technology that isn't close to existing. The world has been permanently changed for all practical purposes because of largely the capitalist model of make money and then spend the extra on things that are important. And most of humanity has been dragged along on this without our say-so, because, hey, capitalism works against democracy. Sorry. So that's what I have to say. End rant.
Do you have anything to add to that, Scott?
I mean, no. anthropogenic climate change is acknowledged globally. I mean, scientists don't like to sway into politics, but it's almost undeniable that humans have caused climate change. And the reason for that has been mass industrialization over different methods to further financial gain for a smaller portion of society. And that's undeniable. So, I mean, if we want to try and go with that still, unfortunately, we won't have very long left. So why not have a change? Why not refocus our thoughts and try something new and listen to Abe?
I think like a huge important part to look at is, and this could be a whole other subject of a podcast, but I think they're really interesting when we look at environmental rights. And I think one of the main problems that we have with looking at environmental rights is we're trying to add it into this human rights language.
Yeah.
And the problem with human rights language is human rights is a very capitalistic idea. Even Karl Marx, the creator of socialism, said that the greatest danger to socialism is human rights, because the idea of society in which the environment is a societal issue. It affects all of us equally in a way that a society like a socialist structure would work. And the problem with trying to put this in human rights and a lot of rights that we look at in civil rights in the US and other rights, I'm not sure the exact language here in the UK would be it, it focuses on the individual. And it's like the rights for me and like focusing on me, where when we look in the environment, it's not just about our rights on things, it's the rights of everyone. So I think that's another reason why we keep going around in this circle about the issue, is we're trying to fix a societal issue through a process that focuses on the individual. And that's, I think, going to be like one of our downfalls throughout the entire situation. So, like, it's not necessarily a bad question or statement that's being made. I think it just shows how broken of a system it is, because we can focus our economics towards fixing the environment. It's just you have to drop profit margins. Like, survivability over profit, I think, has to become the change. And you'd have to work with a new model of capitalism to work around it. And that's just my takeaway from it.
Sadly, we are out of time. I did want to thank you both very much for joining me on this podcast. Now, if anyone ever wants to join us on one of these live Twitches, I do put up the schedule both on Twitch and on the Twitter account. If you want to contact and if you would be interested in joining the podcast or have any questions or debate, you can always email me at rightsandwrongspodcast@gmail.com. Other than that, thank you and join us next time. Have a nice night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.